He said, she said, or technically speaking and simply put.
Hello, Tracy.
Hello, Corey.
How's it going today?
It's going great. It's a little overcast, but nonetheless, after I finish this, I'm going to go pick up little Riley and take her to the park.
Yeah, and spending time with Riley at the park is what it's all about.
It certainly is, and then I get my tan on at the same time. So it works out, put a little coconut oil on, and I get a little tan, and I'm doing okay. Everything's great.
Right, so this is He Said, She Said, mm-hmm. June 2014. We are moving through space and time. What's cooking?
What's cooking is Indian spices. And not sure if you're aware of this, but I am in the midst of writing a new cookbook, Indian Whole Food Recipes. Now, this has been quite a challenge for me, as it's not the difficultness of the recipes, but it's the combination of the spices that makes it so difficult. So when I first commenced doing this, I got to tell you, I thought I bit off more than I could chew. I'm still thinking I bit off more than I can chew because it is challenging. And it is kind of a hit and miss. However, I am slowly but surely getting the hang of it. I know that Indian food isn't quite your favorite, Corey, but nonetheless, you are my test taster.
Well, there's some value in Indian food, there's no doubt. I mean, there's a huge history, a culture, a place on the planet where people have lived for a very, very long time and have been playing around with plants and animals and eating them and combining them in different ways for much, much longer. I mean, we're talking thousands and thousands of years. The oldest form of medicine is Ayurvedic medicine. It's in India.
I know. Well, last night was kind of funny because one of my dance students took me out for dinner and they said, where do you want to go? And I said, I want to go to the curry pot. Oh, my goodness. It was absolutely to die for. It was just so delicious. And I made the aloo gobi the other day, and it turned out kind of gooby. I used the wrong potato. Aloo gobi is a combination of cauliflower and potato mixed with, sautéed with herbs and spices. But I used the wrong potato. And I'm finding that some of the recipes, and I have mentioned this before in other SNUs, that, you know, when you follow a recipe in some recipe books or online recipes, they don't really qualify. When you say peel a potato, there's so many different types of potatoes, which we've discussed, that some turn out mushy and some don't boil as well or some are good for baking. So, yeah, I used the wrong kind of potato. It came out kind of mushy, but it was really tasty. You even liked it. But I had the real aloo gobi when I was at this Indian restaurant, and boy, was it good. So I wasn't too far off. But nonetheless, I'm still full today.
Well, that's why I don't like, as a general rule, eating East Indian food. There's some wonderful value in it, but it tends to feature a lot of carbohydrates, which I tend not to eat too much of as a general rule. So when you go into an East Indian restaurant, you can expect to look at almost every dish as high carbohydrate.
Well, it's not necessarily the actual dish. What it is, it's the rice and the naan and the papadums, so that type of thing, to scoop up all that lovely gravy.
Yes, and that's the part I don't like. I don't like the mushy, gravy, saucy kind of gunky stuff.
Oh.
I just don't like that. I like a piece of fish on a plate. That's
yeah,
what I like.
I know you do. I know it's not your thing, so I was happy that my friend took me out.
But women, I find, like that stuff more so than men, I would say. This is a general observation.
I don't know about
rich in carbohydrates, lots of grains, fried foods, gravy, sauces.
Ugh. No.
No, I'm sure there's lots of guys that like that too, but I would say that overall women would tend to choose that over men.
Yeah. Anyway, the spices are used in different forms. They use them whole, chopped, ground, roasted, sautéed, fried, and as a topping. And some of the spices are added at the end for flavoring and are typically heated in a pan with ghee, and we got to love the ghee, and cooking all before adding in the dish. Now, lighter spices are added last, and spices with a strong flavor added first. So that's kind of a rule of thumb, which I'm finally getting, because I used to throw everything in all together. And to me, when I was making Indian food or whatever, I just throw in a bottle of curry. That was my Indian food. Now, curry, interestingly enough, is not a spice. The term is used by Western people and refers to any dish in Indian cuisine that contains several spices blended together that could be in a gravy base or a dry item. So the word curry is a combination, It's not an actual spice on its own.
The mix of spices, each one is an individual spice, and then they're all mixed in different ways.
Yeah, exactly. So one of the ones that I've kind of gotten into was garam masala. Now, maybe you've heard of this before. I know I've heard of it, and I didn't really have a clue. But I did a little research on it, and I've made it, and I've used it, and it's kind of really cool. So garam masala is a blend of ground spices common in North Indian and other Southern Asian cuisines. So there's a North, South, East, West India, and they all have different styles of cooking.
Different cultures and different religions and even different languages.
Absolutely, like 1600.
Like we think of India. I've been there, as you know, and I've been East, West, North, South, and it's like a different world. So people think here, who haven't been, India is just this chunk of land that's all the same.
Yes.
There's nothing that could be further from the truth.
Well, it's like Vancouver and Toronto. Like millions
or Eastern Canada versus West and Northern Canada. I mean,
exactly.
You've got to go there and check it out to see the variation.
Yeah. I mean, I'm getting a greater appreciation for this. But the word garam refers to intensity of the spices rather than the capsaicin content, which is the heat of the peppers. So garam masala is best made fresh. And just before you begin cooking, if you haven't got time and the patience, then you can make a batch ahead of time. And you can actually keep it for several months in an airtight container. Or you can buy it pre-made in the supermarket. However, as we all know, it works fine, but fresh is best. So here's a quick little summary of how to make garam masala. So you want 2 tablespoons of cumin seeds, 2 tablespoons of coriander seeds, 2 tablespoons of black peppercorns, 1 tablespoon of cardamom pods, 1 cinnamon stick, which is broken in half, and 4 bay leaves, and 1 teaspoon of whole cloves. So what you want to do is you want to get a sauté pan, and you want to heat this sauté pan and let it heat up for 2 minutes. And then you want to add all the spices except for the bay leaf. And you want to put it directly on the heat, and you keep tossing and moving it around. You don't want it to burn. This takes approximately 3 minutes. So after about 3 minutes, then the spices will be nicely toasted, and you'll really get a beautiful smell through it. So what you want to do is you want to set this pan aside, and you want to let it cool. Make sure that the spice mix has cooled down. Then you want to add the bay leaf, okay? Then what you want to do is you want to get a grinder, like a coffee grinder, and add these spices into the coffee grinder. It might take a couple of batches, and you keep grinding and grinding and shaking up the grinder and making sure that it's very fine. And then you pour out the grinder into a glass screw top jar, and you've made your own garam masala. It's that easy. So, and it's nice and fresh, and it can last a couple of months. So you want to keep it in a dark place, and let's say up to 6 months. Like I said, it's best to make your own, but you can buy this already made in an Indian store or in your local supermarket. So, right? And making your own ghee. You can buy ghee in the supermarket or an Indian store, or you can make your own ghee. You know, if you don't have time and you want to make the Indian food, then I can understand that. But if you've got time and you want to experiment, you know, it's more authentic to make it your own. So I'm making my own just to see what happens. So this new cookbook is going to be basically Indian food for dummies, you know, because it's like, for me, I've never really delved into making Indian cuisine, and I'm really excited. It's getting me back into the kitchen again, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you did take on a lot because there's such a history. These people have taken thousands of years to come up with these dishes. You know, it wasn't some individual in a modern kitchen that's been working on it for a few weeks or months or even years. We're talking thousands of year history here.
Yes.
When you were talking about intensity, which reminded me of training, I like that relationship. The intensity of the spice reminds me of lifting heavy, and intensity is a good thing.
This garam masala, this is only one version of it. There are several versions of it, but that's kind of the base. You can add more things to it. So there's always a base. It's kind of like our everyday healthy salad dressing. You've got the base, but then you can add other things to it. So the list goes on and on and on, and it can be quite overwhelming. But this book is going to be very simple and just what you need. If you want to make three or four different Indian dishes, and then you can say that you've cooked Indian food, and then we're going to move on. Who knows what's next on the list of things I'm going to do.
So I wonder if there's a rating, because I know you mentioned capsaicin, which is the chemical compound in cayenne pepper, comes to mind. And there's this Scoville rating system, or heat units, and there's different ways to measure, like the heat that's released by consuming cayenne pepper, which is, you know, generally considered great for circulation, and but there's like mild, medium, hot, and all the way up to this super devilish, like hellfire standard. They have ratings. When you buy cayenne in the store, you can actually get a heat unit or Scoville rating on it to tell you how hot or mild or potent it is.
Yes, well, that Indian restaurant I went to, it says choose spice when ordering. So it goes from 1 to 6, mild, medium, medium hot, hot, extra hot. I went number 2, mild, medium, and it had a kick to it. It really did. And, you know, and Chinese food has the same thing. When you get into the Szechuan, you can go really super hot.
Yes.
But, you know, and I think that's why some of these people stay so healthy.
Is right.
Because they've got this spice, and they need that spice in order to kill any bacteria or whatever. So there you have it.
Well, there's a chemistry to it all, and it has to do with the nerve endings, and spices tend to have or deliver a whole variety of different antioxidants that integrate or mix and mingle with different species of free radicals. That's why it's probably really good to get a wide variety of spices in the diet. You know that the Canadian diet is very bland when it comes to spices as a general rule compared to some of the other cultures worldwide.
Oh, absolutely. Try living in England. It's just like chips. They eat chips with their turkey dinners made with chips and turkey. It's pretty bland.
Yes, you know? And when we go to some of these countries, we just have a hell of a time with their hellfire-like spices.
Yeah.
There's been no climatization. We haven't had any chance to adapt. Mm.
But we're multicultural living in Canada, so we get, especially living in Vancouver, Vernon here is opening up some Japanese restaurants, and they have a lot of Indian restaurants. So, you know, it's getting more multicultural here in the Okanagan area. However, Vancouver has been multicultural for many, many years.
Yeah, so something like turmeric or these spices, even bringing it into your whatever diet you have, if you can find a way, like I like to sprinkle, you know, cayenne flakes or peppers and different spices on different foods to give it a bit of a kick.
Yes.
But in my brain, I'm also thinking that there is some antioxidant value to help support my immune system.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So there you have it. So you see, this Indian food's helpful there, so you got to keep being my guinea pig.
Right on. No problem. Is that it then for that one?
That's it then.
That's it? That's
You're
all.
You're hearing more about it on the other SNUs about my Indian food, so there you go.
Yeah, well, you're proving that you can take any food from any culture and reduce it to the good and the bad, the refined, the processed, the whole food, you know, like white rice in sushi, for example. I won't eat that. It's refined and processed, and its natural state is black or brown or whole, and of course, there's micronutrients not present in white rice that can get you into trouble if you eat it as a staple.
Well, you know, in the Indian food, they use white basmati rice, and in my book, I'm going to be using brown basmati rice.
Right.
And then they use, like, grapeseed oil, whereas I'm going to be using coconut oil. So I'm changing it around. I'm changing the recipes around and making them whole food, right?
So, well, like when you choose an oil, you've got to know where the oil came from, how it was processed, whether it was, you know, mechanically, chemically, if there's solvents involved, you know. So we take a lot for granted. And I think that in today's environment here in Canada, you have to assume that almost everything that you buy in a grocery store has been devitalized to increase its shelf life.
Yeah, that's kind of creepy when you think about that. You don't know how long something's been sitting on that shelf.
Well, any, like a natural, clean, fresh, living oil will spoil rapidly.
Yes.
So this is the difference in the mindset, and I don't see whole food consciousness in the mindset of a lot of chefs, like big-name chefs.
Yeah,
they are
exactly.
Just focusing on the pleasure of the experience of eating the food and its visual presentation,
yes,
not
absolutely.
The long-term effects of eating it, which I think they completely negate the most important element of food itself.
You got that right.
And you got that down.
I watch these chefs on TV. They're looking older and they're getting heavier and heavier and heavier. I'm sure the food is absolutely delicious, but nonetheless not health conscious.
Right. So let's keep the health consciousness in mind, shall we?
Okay, let's do that, shall we?
So who was last month's special guest?
Last month's special guest was Dr. Gifford Jones. Wow, what a guy. He's 91 years old, and that guy is rip-roaring and raring to go. He writes for the Epoch Times. He's the author of 7 books, and he's had quite the career as a medical doctor and a journalist now, and he is also a friend of Linus Pauling. He had a nice relationship with him and learned a lot from Linus Pauling. And one of the things that he did say that Linus Pauling worked with was that you can cure polio, measles, meningitis, and even snake bites by high doses of intravenous of vitamin C, like 100,000 milligrams. So I'm loving that. He's a man of my heart because we love our vitamin C powder, right?
Totally, yeah. Anyone who's a friend of Linus Pauling is a friend of mine. Few people today, you know, I go in health food stores and they don't even know who the dude is.
Yeah.
Which is really an unfortunate shame.
I know.
If you work in a health food store and you do not know who Linus Pauling is, you don't know your business.
Yes. So anyway, he talks about diabetes, heart attack, and obesity, which are the most common diseases in Canada. And if you start young, it's all about prevention, which we always talk about, and high doses of vitamin C each day will prevent these diseases. Now, you got to start slow. He's talking like about 10 milligrams, which is like 10 grams a day. Now, you don't start with that.
Yes.
Okay. So, yeah, he says start slowly and work your way up, right? So that's what we do. We've worked our way up over the years, and it seems to be working for us. So he believes in preventative medicine early in life. So get your kids onto it. That's when you start. It's like fire prevention. You start teaching your kids, don't play with matches, right? He led the crusade for legalizing heroin for terminal cancer pain. This is very interesting. And he was ridiculed and criticized, and he says that he has a lot of scars on his back from this crusade. He says that heroin gives the feeling of euphoria, and it moves into the bloodstream immediately, whereas morphine doesn't. And he noticed that in Great Britain, in the hospital emergency for heart attack, labor, and cancer pain, they used heroin to ease the pain. So, you know, there's use and abuse in this type of thing, right? So there's lots to be said about drugs, like natural drugs.
Well, he's an example of a physician who is committed to not harming his patients.
Yes.
And also, he's an advocate of doctor-assisted suicide. And it was nice to see, because I'm definitely pro-euthanasia, and my life is my own. Nobody anywhere gets to tell me what to do with my fucking life.
Watch your language.
Yeah, I know. I get so riled up about this because who are these a-holes around me and on the planet that have the gall to invade me and tell me what I can and cannot do with my life? It's not their life. It's my life. Yes, I am pro-suicide, depending upon the situation, and try and stop someone from committing suicide. Then people say, oh, my God, how can you say that? I say, I'm not telling people to commit suicide. And if they want to, they can. And if somebody wants to, if somebody really, truly wants to kill themselves, you can't stop them.
Right. Well, let's say you're 80 years old and you've been terminally ill for 10 years. Hello. But I just thought, recapping on what you just talked about, nobody has control over your life. Well, you're married, dear.
Yes, but if I wanted to, I could do myself in and you'd find me laying on the floor.
Oh, yeah.
Now, if I really wanted to, this is why it's insane and ridiculous and completely irrational to have a law that says you can't do it. What I see in my head is the dead body being rolled into the courtroom and the jury and the lawyers having their debates and discussions and fights, and then they find the dead body guilty of murder.
So he's also an advocate of medical marijuana, which is great, and this man is definitely a good doctor, and because he took the oath of to not harm the patient, and he truly tried to practice this, and he wants to help ease the pain of the terminally ill. And he says that illness can be eased and prevented by natural remedies. Go to the natural remedies first over the meds.
Yeah.
And then, you know, there's a time and a place for prescription drugs. There's always a time and a place for that. But go to the natural remedies first, prevention. And he's awesome. So thanks very much, Giff. We really appreciate your interview.
Yes, and I just wanted to refer to what I was trying to get through there until you interrupted me, that in Quebec, they have recently passed legislation. It's called the End of Life Care Bill, where now it is legal for terminally ill patients to bring in a physician and end their life based on their desire to do so, very much like in the Netherlands and a couple of other countries. And for me, this is a very progressive time to actually see this coming to fruition, because it shows the elevation of logic and the preservation of the individual's right to their own life, which slowly but surely we've lost control of in the country that we call so free. But you can't kill yourself legally here. And there's a lot of things that you can't do legally here, you know, democracy under law. But this is, for me, a very positive change in the right direction on a global level.
Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah. And boy, I'll tell you what, I watched a debate on this on television, and boy, do people get heated.
Yeah.
And what I like to see is the fear of death rising in the veins in people. I think that those who are against this right to die are terrified themselves of their own death, and they're terrified of losing other people that they would like to control. Imagine having a mother or father who's lived their entire life and they have the right to their own life, to end it whenever they want, because they can do it anyway. That's the ridiculousness of this whole thing. You can make it against the law. It's like prohibition. You can make it against the law to kill yourself, and yet we still have suicide. The question is why? Why do we have it? That's what nobody seems to care about who seems to be against doing that. They're not concerned about cause. They're only focusing on the effect. Why would anyone at a young age want to do themselves in? Well, why don't we seek out those reasons and come to terms with them philosophically? And then I think we have a much better understanding of humanity and you know, like why people are doing this. I just watched an incredible show. A lot of the Japanese swordsmen, you know, they were well known to do themselves in. It was like an honorable thing to do. Those swordsmen in Japan?
Samurai.
The samurai, yes. Some of these writers of these scripts, and they put these movies together, and they're trying to stay true to the original tradition of the samurai and the emperor and the history of ancient Japan, etc. And I find it quite interesting that when the time comes, the emperor would permit the samurai, if they had chained themselves or done something like disobeyed the king or the emperor, they would then be given the opportunity to kill themselves with honor as opposed to being executed by the soldiers. So anyway, it's all very interesting, and it raises a lot of heat and creates a huge storm in people. And I think that eventually we're going to see all of this moving in the direction that I'm speaking towards, and that is the right to one's own life and how to live it and get rid of this freaking prohibition garbage.
Yes, there you have it.
What's the hot topic? Let's go for it.
Well, the hot topic is proving you are right can be wrong. What happened to me, as per usual, I'm always bitching about this, about being a pedestrian. Although it was my right to cross the street at a designated area, the car doesn't stop, and I end up in the hospital in a body cast saying I was right. No, I didn't end up in a body cast, and I didn't end up in the hospital. But you see, people will go to lengths to prove that they are right by doing this. And I could just see myself. That would be me with my Sicilian temper and all that, saying, oh, yeah, I was right, you were wrong, and here I am in the hospital bed. So, you know, you just have to, if you can't beat them, you kind of got to join them. So I just wait now until they stop for me. I always waited, but I just let them know that I was going across when they were way down the street. But however, some don't stop. They will keep on going, and they'll look right at you, and they'll keep on going. And that just would infuriate me. But as I said, proving that I was right can be wrong. So this type of analogy can ripple out into other aspects of one's life.
Well, in nature, right? There's no such thing as morality. The way animals interact, you know, an animal, before it makes its kill, doesn't hesitate and say, oh my goodness, look at that little tiny baby. I think I'll pass on it today. No. So they're driven by instinct, the need to consume, and the need to survive. And so are humans. But we do have an invention of morality, and I like it. And I think people like to think of themselves as being somewhat moral, some more, some less. But the fact is, as I said to you today, might is right. It still is the overriding principle. You can walk across the street and not look at the cars, and you can assume, and you'd be right, that you have the right of way. You're in the pedestrian crosswalk, the yellow light's going off and on. Now, that doesn't mean, though, that the person who's coming down the street towards you and that's going to blindside you even cares about you, even cares about the law. So let's say that you walk out and they run you over and you're dead. And I've said this to other people. Now we can put on your tombstone, on the grave, you're buried 6 feet under, that Tracy Hawley was right.
That's the thing.
So you get to be right, although you're gone, you're terminated, you're unaware of all of this, and all we do is look at it. So I've always thought about that, and when I've traveled worldwide, I put myself into some extremely vulnerable situations where I could very easily have been killed and terminated. And so that is why, for example, in Peru, and this band of thieves kind of identified the fact that I was a foreigner, and they chased me out of this pub I was in. I didn't stand there and wait for them to knife me to death and steal my money or whatever. I ran like the Dickens. I took off so fast they couldn't catch me. What I'm saying is you've got to keep your head up and your eyes open. Mm-hmm. It's all about preservation of life.
Exactly.
You can't assume that the other person has the same morality that you do.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I learned that the other day when I almost got killed by a car. I learned that the other day.
And you called me and you were just shaking. I could feel you shaking on the other side of the phone.
I just said, it's not worth it. You know what I mean? So, you know, you got to play the game, which infuriates me. But nonetheless, that's just the way it is. Because every time I would walk out of this house, I'd always say, and you too, you said, and Ruby, that we always have a story to tell about, we call it redneck, you know.
This is a redneck town when it comes to pedestrians and drivers.
Don't care. No. There's no sidewalks. Half of the streets don't have sidewalks. You're strolling with the baby down the street, and there's cars parked on both sides. So you have to walk in the middle of the road, and these cars don't stop for you. They don't care. And I just don't get it. I just keep thinking, what about if this was your kid or your grandmother or your wife? Would you, like, speed up?
Well, it's called the group think. It's majority rule. This is what we're all doing and all means most. Canada is a democracy, or so we think we are. And so the majority rules in a democracy, and this is why I agree with Plato, and he said that majority rule sucks when the majority of the society are demented and sick and perverse and morally corrupted.
Yeah, I just don't, you know, I mean, you've got to be aware of other people around you, you know, like open doors for somebody whose hands are full, or just, you know, be cordial. But a lot of that ain't going on anymore. So, you know, and when somebody opens the door for me, or man or woman, it's just a chivalry, man. I'm just, and I always thank them, and they're, you know, and when they're very pleased that you even recognize the fact that they did a courtesy. Even, you know what I mean? So,
well, look at medicine. Look at everything around us. The entire modality, the modus operandi of almost everything is all driven by profit, not by morality.
Yeah.
I was reading some of the Native American Indian sayings, and it says that if you lie with dogs, you're bound to pick up a few fleas. There's a lot of truth in that. So, you know, when I walk out the door, we're walkers, and the reason that we walk is because we want to preserve our posture and use the feet till the day that we die that we were given as an advantage. And there's very few people that appreciate or even understand what that means. Because let's face it, the majority of Canadians are not fit. They're not interested in fitness, and they're not interested in wellness or health because they eat like crap. Really, think of it. I mean, the majority of people. So they don't care about health. They might talk a good game, but a man or a woman is defined by what they do, not by what they say. So you see them eating the crap and the garbage, like we saw the other day at the food court at one of these events here in Vernon. The poutine that people eat, it's just the most wretched, sick, horrible thing I've ever seen a human consume.
It's like a heart attack waiting to happen.
Yes, and I've seen media reporting on it, and they make a joke about it, and all these celebrities are eating it, and I just say, what are you? Does anybody on this planet have any understanding at all of food chemistry and the will to live and the relationship in your head between what you consume and how you live and whether or not you're going to live today or not? I mean, I just sometimes wonder, but...
But you know what? The people listening to this SNU are.
I know.
Anyway, there you have it. That's our hot topic. So that was pretty.
Which was hotter, that or our previous conversation?
I don't know.
Or what about the peppers? That was pretty hot too, hon.
I know.
I think we need a Scoville rating for these topics. Okay, yeah. Then before we talk about them, we can give it a rating, yeah. How hot it's going to be.
Oh, right, exactly.
Okay, that's great. What's your final word?
My final word is by Ruth E. Renkel. Sometimes the poorest man leaves his children the richest inheritance. Happy Father's Day!